Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September 19th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is John de Graaf. Today's session titled Television and Social Change, Empowering the Poor. Let's listen in.
Won't last as long, so you'll still be out of here about the same time. The theme tonight is social justice. And concern for the least of those, our brothers. And tonight might be called Catholic night for the Lutherans, but the shows you're going to see tonight will have a lot more to do with Catholics than Lutherans. Lutheran night was Monday night. So tonight is Catholic night. Excerpt I'm going to show is from a film I made in 1990, and I had the opportunity to spend time in a Guatemalan refugee camp in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and do a story about Mayan Indian refugees from Guatemala who were restoring an old Mayan city in Mexico. I should say right off the bat, kind of a downer, especially what you're going to see. This is a pretty sad story, and the first one. The second piece I'm going to show you, which takes place in San Antonio, Texas, is an upper, so you'll be able to leave here feeling good, but I warn you that some of the content of the first piece is heartbreaking. If any of you know about Guatemala and the history of Guatemala, it's not a place where I think we as Americans can be terribly proud of our activities. Going way back to 1954, when the CIA, as it were, actually overthrew a democratically elected government in Guatemala. And for years thereafter, decades really, there was kind of continual warring between an elite primarily of Spanish extraction and the poor of the country, primarily of indigenous Mayan Indian extraction. And this led at times to very brutal situations in which many people were massacred, killed. And then in 1977, when Jimmy Carter became president of the United States, he cut off military aid to Guatemala. It was an act, a human rights act, to try to prevent some of the abuses that were occurring with both training from the United States of Guatemalan military officers and with Guatemalan with weapons that came from the United States. Now, in the interim, in the period from 1977 to 1981, another country took the United States' place in supplying the weapons for the Guatemalan military, and much of the repression continued. Can anybody guess what that country might have been? Pardon?
Cuba?
No. Cuba, if anything, was supporting the other side. who? Anybody can guess?
Israel.
Oh. Yeah. The weapons being used, instead of being American rifles, were Uzis and Israeli weapons. And there was some feeling that Israel was doing this as kind of payback to the United States for supporting it, so that some of the same policies could continue, even though the U.S. official policy was no support for the Guatemalan military. But the repression still did decline considerably. Israel did not put nearly as much support in as we had. And Jimmy Carter and his policies led to a real reduction of these killings that were taking place in Guatemala. When Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980 and took office in 1981, he reversed the policy virtually immediately and began resupplying the Guatemalan military. And it was at that time right in the period 1981 and 1982 that the most serious repression, abuses, massacres, and terrible things occurred, and the repression of the poor and native population. And it was at that time that the refugees, nearly a million of them, left Guatemala and streamed into Mexico, into the camps where I visited them some 7-8 years later, and where this story begins.
Return of the Maya is made possible by financial support from Newt Closter, from the Washington Commission for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and from viewers like you.
Early in the morning, workers arrived at the Mayan city of Etza in southern Mexico. They've come here to awaken Etza from its slumber of 1,000 years. The emerging city is spectacular. There's more to this excavation than first meets the eye, more than just another story about archaeology. These workers are direct descendants of the ancient Maya who built the metropolis of Etza. They're also exiles, forced a decade ago to flee their homeland of Guatemala. It was an arduous journey, filled with violence and terror, death and loss of dignity. But now, from these stones, these long-forgotten ruins, they are recovering their heritage and their home.
This is a project useful for the people, for the Guatemalan people, for the Mexican people, for the people of all the world.
Each year, the villagers of Quetzal Iznan gather to watch the deer dance, a remnant of the ancient indigenous pageantry of the Americas. Since the 16th century Spanish conquest of the Guatemalan highlands, this dance has contained symbols of Indian resistance, cues meant to be understood only by the Maya. Some dancers wear costumes originally designed to flatter Spanish overlords, but the comic abduction of the hunter carries a message of mockery. Long before Columbus, the Maya were lords of a vast empire, encompassing much of what is now Central America and the Yucatan Peninsula. Yet for nearly 500 years, they've been treated as second-class citizens in their own lands. Quetzal Iznan, a refugee camp near the Mexican city of Campeche, is home to several thousand Guatemalan exiles. Throughout the world, 17 million uprooted people live in camps like this one. Jointly administered by the United Nations and by a Mexican government agency called COMAR, the camp is Spartan, but well organized by the refugees themselves. At lunchtime in Quetzal, Pizza listener, Rosa Lopez prepares the meal, while her husband Jose watches. They speak Ishiga, one of 30 living languages of the Maya family. Today's meal is special. There are eggs to go with the corn tortillas that provide the heart of the refugee diet. The ancient Maya believed their gods fashioned human beings from corn. Their descendants here can afford little else. After lunch, the Lopez family joins others at Quetzalitzna's small cemetery. It is November the 2nd, the Day of the Dead. The refugees gather at the graves of relatives to honor them. In times like this, they most vividly remember Guatemala. In the early 1980s, Guatemala was a nation at war.
They killed many people with machetes, and they burned people in their houses.
The troubles began a decade earlier when urban workers, students, and peasants challenged military rule and the most unequal distribution of land and income in Central America.
The peasants organized and protested with strikes. They formed committees asking for better food, for schools, for roads, for electric power in the poorer areas.
The military's response was a wave of repression.
Labor leaders, Catholic priests, a newspaper person, a lawyer who supported the workers, anybody who dared to speak out for the poor was being picked up.
Frustrated in their efforts to achieve peaceful reform, many peasants joined leftist guerrilla movements. Guatemala's military leaders declared all-out war against them. Entire villages suspected of sympathy with the rebels were attacked by the army.
444, I think, was the count of villages that were totally destroyed. Girls were coming to the house crying and weeping, seeing they had seen massacres, they had seen their family killed, they had seen whole villages being burned.
I saw that they were burning. They were burning my neighbor. So I said, it's best we go right away. And I pulled together all my family and we just left everything.
At least 75,000 people died. 40,000 disappeared. Hardest hit were Guatemala's poorest people, the Maya. More than 100,000 of them sought refuge in Mexico. At first, the refugees were housed in camps near the border, but land shortages and continued attacks on the camps by the Guatemalan troops who crossed the unprotected Mexican frontier brought a change. In 1984, many of the refugees were uprooted once again, moved from the border state of Chiapas to scattered sites in the Yucatan Peninsula. Their first shelters were rough warehouses.
Fue una vida muy triste. Toda la gente ahí estábamos sufriendo de tanto de comida y como de dormir.
It was the very sad life. All of us suffered from a lack of food and from sleeping problems. Many of the children appeared to be very sleepy. We lived like that for more than a month before they moved us to this camp at Quetzal.
Here, they started all over again, building wooden houses, digging wells, planting fruit trees and gardens, trying hard to maintain their traditions in a new environment. The new camp was named named for the nearby Etzanar ruins, and for the Quetzal, Guatemala's colorful national bird, which always dies in captivity. Opportunities for gainful employment here are few, unskilled labor in surrounding fields or in nearby towns. Yet the people of Quetzal Etzanar have a reason for optimism. For the past few years, teams of about 30 men from Quetzal Etzanar have been restoring the ancient Mayan ruins that lie only a few miles from the refugee camp. The director of the project is a young Mexican archaeologist, Dr. Antonio Benavides.
We are looking for several walls, several other rooms that haven't been excavated. And this typical architecture is of late classic, I mean 600 to 900 after Christ. This hill is a pyramid because here at the Great Apocalypse you have several other examples of temples on the island.
Because we have just
a nice hill with
a
vegetation.
Arya Sayanma. The rest of the film kind of goes into the story of the ruins and the work project there. Though at the end of the film, there's kind of an update, which is that a lot of the money got cut out. And eventually, these refugees did return to Guatemala, and the final peace settlement was reached in the mid-1990s. When they first went back, a number were actually killed. There was still some limited killing by paramilitary groups and others in Guatemala going back when the first wave of refugees returned to Guatemala. But that has since changed. The situation there is quite a bit improved at this point, but of course the lives of people are still very, very difficult, and the poverty and everything still remains. Any questions about? Yes?
When did Rigoberto Menchú come in?
Rigoberto Menchú?
Uh-huh.
Rigoberta Menchú, if you haven't heard the name, is a Guatemalan Indian woman who wrote a book primarily about that period of 1981-82 when the repression was going on, about her family. It's somewhat controversial. There are claims that she, in writing the book, it wasn't really all about her family, that she was bringing in a kind of a composite of other stories she had heard and so forth. But she became a very important spokeswoman for the Guatemalan indigenous cause, and there were movies made about her and other things, I think, that helped turn a lot of attention of people in this country toward what was going on, and again led to something of a reduction of the level of military aid that was being put into Guatemala under the Reagan administration. Yes?
I just have a comment. I was involved in the early 90s with a group of refugees who went back from Comitán on the other side in Chiapas.
Uh-huh.
And it's an interesting process to be in Guatemala. I was there last year again for a while, that having gone from military rule to civil rule then, to me, Guatemala is a country that is waiting to cry and grieve for what happened since 54, and mostly in the men. The women still dress in really brilliant colors and they're beautiful, and the men seem really, really defeated.
I think that what you're saying is it was even noticeable in the camps when I was there. And it was a very moving experience to spend time there. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time. I was in the camp for a little over 2 weeks filming and in the neighboring town. And we had, my partner on the project had been down there for some time before doing research. And this particular project was being supported primarily by the European countries, particularly by the Scandinavian countries who were giving aid to this. And so the woman, Arya Saijonmaa, who just comes into the program at this point, was a, is a Finnish actress and singer and a United Nations, one of the sort of honorary United Nations representatives for refugees. And she was spending a lot of time at that time going around the world and trying to get people to understand the plight of refugees. And she actually provided the funding through a Norwegian businessman for the making of the film. A Norwegian shipbuilder, actually.
This summer, our granddaughter, who goes to Western in Bellingham, she joined in with a Presbyterian mission group that went to Guatemala. They worked in an orphanage, and then they spent the rest of the week doing a, kind of like a Habitat for Humanity home, where a skilled carpenter built the kind of panels, and then the youth went in and built a house for a lady who had children. And I know that she was, she wants to go back again next year. She thought the people were very warm, and she felt like she was actually doing something and contributing.
Oh, that's great. It's very important. Actually, one of the leading scholars on the whole history of this period in Guatemala is at Western, and he was the major, the prime consultant to this film for its historical accuracy. And other things, a fellow named James Lauki. He's a professor she made. She
well,
made,
that may have been no, where yeah, she got her inspiration, but she actually went with this Presbyterian youth group that was doing a mission.
Yes?
We have a nephew back home that's in a church group down there, and I don't know how many times in a year they go down there. When people on their vacation, they go, and they take things like computers down, and they build schools, and the, some doctors go down and do work there. And apparently our nephew's been going back maybe 5 or 6 years already.
That's great. I understand a lot of the colleges like Augsburg and places have had continual programs doing doing that kind of thing too. And I think it's you know, it's very, very important. But there is a very, and I'm sorry, I said a million, I meant 100,000 in terms of the refugees who came across the border. As soon as I heard it in the film, I realized that sometimes I, I forget things. And, yeah. So one story I wanted to tell before going on to the next program is that the home you saw in the refugee camp, or the Lopez family, and of course, it was sort of a little bit of humor that the guy was sort of standing around watching while the women did all the work. It seems to happen everywhere in the world. But they invited us. We'd actually, this had come about because their son, who was a little kid named Sebastian, took a real liking to us. In fact, all the kids took a liking to these guys with the cameras and all that stuff. And they, the kids were in school, and we spent a lot of time at the kids' school. And these kids were just amazing. I mean, they had, these are the poorest kids I've ever seen. I'm sure there are poorer, but they had literally nothing except a few clothes on their back and these slat huts that were created in the camps. And so we would give the kids those very simple things like paper and pens and things like that. And the kids would draw all day. They could be kept busy and entertained with very, very little and be very excited about it. Sometimes they would draw pictures that were downright scary. of helicopters and shooting and all kind of things that they had actually witnessed as small children. But this one kid, Sebastian, he got very attached to it. He was our shadow. I mean, he literally followed us all the time, everywhere in the camp. And so we got to know his parents, and we interviewed his father about their experience. And then they invited us over for a meal at their home, and they had, as you saw, eggs, which was very unusual because most of the meals were simply tortillas and a few beans and so forth. But about midway through the meal, Rosa, the woman, went and filled four glasses, there were four of us, full of water. And then, and of course, this was the kind of thing where she brought them to us, and we're our feeling of it, drinking the water in that sort of situation was not real good. And we might have refused, we might have made some excuse and said, oh, we're not thirsty or something, if it was just water. But what she had done was she had gone and taken a little bit of powdered milk, which they had was given, you know, and they had very little as a family, and put, you know, a little bit of that into each one of the glasses, and which was this for the state that they were in, a tremendously generous gesture. And so she brought those and put them in front of us, and was like looking at it and thinking, oh, what do? You know, and realizing that there was only one thing we could do, which was to drink it, because it simply would be rude and unthoughtful to do otherwise. So we did, and of course we thought we were going to become deathly sick, but none of us got sick. So it had a happy ending. Any other questions before we go on to the next? Yes.
Is there any mention of the SOA in this documentary, or is that too big of an issue to even touch on?
The SOA.
Schools of America's in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Oh, there isn't in this documentary. No, but certainly a great number of these Guatemalan military officers and people who conducted the repression were trained at places like the School of the Americas. No question about it.
And they're involved in the El Mazote massacre in Guatemala.
Yes. Yeah, many of you have probably heard of the School of the Americas, where lots of people get arrested all the time trying to close it down, and where various military folks who come up from Latin America are trained in everything from, you know, using weapons to repress to techniques of torture and other kinds of things.
One of the things that the Discovery Channel's found was that they've taken under President Eisenhower, that's when that war actually started.
Right, the 54, right.
Under the preventing communism from taking over Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the statistics, they said that over 100,000 people were killed in the before 1965. 54 to 65.
It could well be true. I mean, I don't know the numbers, but I definitely know that those figures in the early 80s, they were 75,000 just in 81 and 82 was the best estimate. So we see, unfortunately, terrorism throughout our world. The second clip I'm going to show you is from a film that I did a little bit earlier, actually in 1985. It's from a film called God and Money. And you've all heard the line about, you know, you can't serve two masters. You can't serve both God and money. You must love one and hate the other. And this particular film, it was a look. I spent a good part of the year following a Catholic parish in Seattle, and two Catholics who were on opposite sides of a little argument that was going on within the Catholic Church at that time over a pastoral letter that the American Catholic bishops were writing about the U.S. economy. And it ended up coming out, it was called Economic Justice for All. And the committee led by Bishop Weakland from Milwaukee put together that letter, and they had discussions in Catholic churches throughout the United States for a period of many, many months trying to draft this document that would make clear the Catholic position on things like Reaganomics, but also on poverty. And one of the major expressions of Catholic social doctrine that came out in the letter was the idea of organizations, not simply charity for the poor, but organizations that would help poor people organize and change their circumstances. And the key Catholic organization that encouraged building of community groups for social change and to end poverty was a group called the Campaign for Human Development of the Catholic Church. And this particular segment that you're going to see takes place in San Antonio, Texas in 1985, and it's a look at a very remarkable organization that was formed in the Catholic churches of San Antonio, and that in some very key ways actually transformed that city.
From an effort to get people away from handout, to get people away from service. Service is good, it has a purpose, there are people that should do it, but it doesn't break the chains of poverty. In order to make change, you have to have power. In order to have power, you have to be organized.
During the past decade, Beatriz Cortez has learned how to organize. As a member and a past president of the Campaign for Human Development's greatest success story, a citizens' organization that changed a city. San Antonio, Texas, an all-American city with a Mexican flavor. Old-world charm brings tourists to the Riverwalk. Historical legend draws them to the Alamo.
You see, all the propaganda about how great San Antonio is, but it hasn't since. And there is a shadow side. And it's our people who live in that shadow side. It's God's people who live in that shadow side.
See, I'm going to go for the bottom. The bottom is very important to us, so really streets and drainage.
In a poor Mexican-American barrio of San Antonio, Virginia Ramirez of COPS, Communities Organized for Public Service, goes door to door asking her neighbors to vote for a municipal bond. Catholic bishops say poor Americans can empower themselves to be full participants in our economic and political life by working together for change. COPS is one example of what they mean.
Substation.
12 years ago, the first COPS organizers went door to door here, laying the groundwork for an organization that would bring political power to San Antonio's Hispanic majority. In those days, the Hispanics of San Antonio felt powerless and forgotten. Each year on Good Friday, they remember how it was.
People were treated as objects rather than people. I used to hear comments when I was younger, oh, it's okay, he's just a Mexican.
San Antonio's Mexican Americans had many burdens. Employers who wouldn't hire them, banks who wouldn't lend money in their neighborhoods, poor housing, and wages that were among the lowest in America.
They were very busy advertising that San Antonio was a place to come and build industry because you could find cheap Mexican and black labor.
Every year, the people of the Barrios to reenact the crucifixion of Christ. For them, the scene evokes memories of terrible conditions once passively endured.
There was no sidewalks. I didn't know what a sidewalk was.
The trash used to not get picked up. The streets were never repaired. The drainage was horrible.
You could say it looked like a third world country.
And the city really was not doing anything to alleviate those situations.
And it wasn't that people didn't care, it was that we didn't know how to organize. We didn't know how to fight.
Individuals, leaders in local Catholic churches, believed they could change San Antonio.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses.
The First Council organizers, armed with funding from the Campaign for Human Development, began to mobilize their neighbors.
People were skeptics, and they were saying an organization like COPS will never come to be because Mexican Americans are about two things. They're about family and they're about church, and so you will never get them involved in meetings.
But what some saw as a problem, COPS organizers saw as an opportunity. They began to look to religious leaders to encourage participation in the new organization. In parishes throughout San Antonio, the clergy responded.
En lo que combatimos aquí, el pan y el vino, eso es lo que queremos combatir afuera. Y van a ver cómo se llenan las iglesias. ¿Por qué? Porque la gente me sigue, me aman, realmente me aman. Porque están luchando conmigo a mejorar mi vida.
Most of San Antonio's Catholic churches joined COPS, each pledging a portion of their annual income to support the organization.
In the beginning, COPS had to use some pretty strong tactics to get the attention of the community, both the press and the powers that be.
Jan Jarbo of the San Antonio Express News remembers some of those tactics.
They were trying to dramatize the need for jobs in their areas. And so they took 300 COPS people, went down to a major downtown department store, Joski's, and tried on clothes. It's called a tie-up. They just literally stopped all activity in the department store for several hours and then they left.
There were nuns that were kind of trying on bits and pieces of bridal gowns, and there were people who were picking up coats, and everybody was putting everything back, but nobody was buying anything.
They went to the largest bank in San Antonio at the time, Frost Bank, and made change, just tied up all the tellers for an hour or two making change. That got a lot of our attention.
And we found out that actually our money was being used in Dallas for big industry and in other places and so on. So we said, unless we can, unless that money can be lent back to the community, we probably will simply boycott the banks.
Civic leaders began to listen. Thousands of people joined COPS. Quickly, they were trained to confront politicians and business people with facts and finesse.
We are, in a sense, in the University of COPS. We learn about issues, we know how to address them, we research them. We can take contracts apart and look at the positives and the negatives.
As a result of our involvement with COPS, people who never would stand up in front of the church people, let alone the mayor, are not afraid to do that
Municipal and business services in Barrios improved dramatically. Feeling a new sense of power, more Mexican-Americans began voting, electing candidates sympathetic to Cox. The organization won victory after victory. New drainage projects stopping the flooding that had always plagued poorer sections of the city. New parks, schools, and libraries. Better jobs and improved housing.
In the issues that we address, like utility rates, all of the city benefits because we keep utility rates down.
Cops has had tremendous success in the last 12 years here in San Antonio. And I think that Cops is a real model for other cities, for other organizations, to learn how it can be done, that it is possible to organize the poor.
Urbaso supports the Wheatland Committee's letter. He and other COPS leaders agree with its emphasis on empowering the poor.
We are just excited about it, and we're spending a lot of time trying to let people know about the letter. We're passing it out in English and in Spanish and bits and pieces, and having these sessions, workshops on the pastoral letter.
At one such workshop, Urbaso prepares COPS members to encourage San Antonio's Archbishop to defend the letter.
For a few minutes, you are the Archbishop of San Antonio. I want you to think the way he thinks. I want you to talk the way he talks.
Your Excellency, I'm Maris Rigars.
Hi, hija. Don't say Excellency. I am Patrick Flores. Oh,
okay, Patrick Flores.
Ready, watch this. Archbishop. In your letter, you talk to us about unemployment. We know about unemployment, don't we?
Yes!
In your letter, you talk to us about the lack of jobs in the city of San Antonio. And we know about jobs here in San Antonio, don't we?
Yes!
We want to tell the Archbishop, we know that they're going to go and some people are going to try to change the letter. We want to be very clear on what we believe are the essential elements in that letter. You talk about how work, that we have a right to work, and that's essential to our dignity as human beings. Don't let them change that, right?
Right.
You talk about a family wage. This is something new, and a lot of business people are going to talk against you. Please, don't let them change that, right?
Right.
We cannot just read this letter and not do anything about it. Like all of you know, you get a love letter, and you read it, you expect something's going to come afterwards. That's not just words on a piece of paper. There's some kind of relationship that's going to be established. Well, this is a love letter from our bishops to us. And now we want to respond in action.
In the spring of 1985, action for COPS meant working to pass the bond, $100 million in capital improvements that would bring needed services to the barrios.
What are the enemies of this bond? I mean, what are the attitudes that you're going to be fighting when you walk for the bond?
You have the
anti-tax attitude. Lots of people are saying that taxes should not go up. What is the COPS philosophy about tax?
They're going to tax.
We don't mind paying for it as long as we know where it's going.
The reason we want the bond to pass is because that money is going to come into our communities.
Don't be fooled by this business about city waste. You have proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that COPS knows how to do capital improvements. COPS knows how to spend money on streets and on drainage, and it hasn't stopped you yet. $500 million. Almost any one of you can point to the streets and the drainage projects in your own neighborhoods. We have got to have this $100 million insurance policy for our communities. And without it, we don't have anything. There is no alternative. And if we don't pass this bond, then on April 7th, there will be nothing for drainage, for streets, for police protection, and for the other essential elements of the quality of life in our communities. You ready to go get out of the bond?
Election day, the Saturday before Easter.
Polls predict a close vote count on the bonds as cops activists prepare to turn out the people in their neighborhoods.
For those of us that are going to be walking around today, those of you that are going to be way over there on the west side, know that the east side is going to be walking, that the south side is going to be walking, and remember that no matter how many dogs come out at you and how many other things you might have, we're in it together. When we come back together, we're going to have a victory for the block.
As the votes poured in throughout the day, COPS members wondered anxiously whether their efforts would be rewarded.
Que la luz de Cristo resucitado y glorioso.
That night, in the barrios of San Antonio, the hope of Easter took on an earthly aspect as well. The results were in. The bonds had won by a margin of 2-1. George once thought his only hope for a better economic future was to leave San Antonio. But having seen what COPS has accomplished, he now feels differently.
People now have hope. They have a sense of if we continue doing what we're doing, things will get a lot better and our lives will be enriched. COPS also give me a sense of power that we can do something, that we can change our lives, that we can have an impact on our future. And that used to be in the hands of somebody else, but now it's in our hands. Now we control our destiny.
Thank you. Anyway, as you might imagine, that was a fun experience to be able to do that. And it just so happened that all these things were kind of going on the one week we were in San Antonio filming it. That wasn't purely by accident, but we'd asked beforehand, you know, some of the things that we might see to illustrate what they were doing. And they said, well, we've got this election campaign going on, we're working on that and stuff. And, well, when's the election? Oh, it's the Saturday before Easter. Well, what else happened? So pretty soon we found out that, in fact, there would be all these religious things going on. And then one of the things that was the case in San Antonio, and as a filmmaker, you're always trying to think about how do I make this visual? Because you can write a book and you can write the visuals. I mean, if you're doing radio, you don't really need the visuals, or you can talk about it to give people an idea. But when you're doing film and television, you have to have something visual. And one of the things we discovered when we were researching this story was that San Antonio was, these people had this history of being victimized by flooding and by a whole pattern, for instance, of mismanagement that consistently would take money from the poor areas of the city and spend it on projects in the wealthier Anglo-Northern parts of the city. And that, you know, people just felt frustrated. But there was no footage of this. There weren't even any interesting still photographs of this. And it was, how will we convey this? And so then we had the idea that maybe we would convey this sense of people's despair and what was happening through the passion play. And that was, I'll tell you, that was one of the hardest experiences I've ever had. And I'm sure for the cameraman, it was just as hard, if not harder. I was carrying a tripod. We had, well, the temperature was 88 degrees. And we walked 4 miles through the streets of San Antonio. And it was, of course, hardest for the poor guy who was playing Christ, who had to literally carry this rather heavy cross for this entire thing through the streets. They say that nobody ever plays the part of Jesus more than once in San Antonio in the Passion Play, because it literally is a difficult experience. But it was fascinating to see what the people were doing. And of course, the other thing was, we had no idea how the vote would turn out. So we were there the day of the election and prepared to write a completely different script. Well, they lost, but they've still got hope. And all this other stuff. So it was very nice that it didn't turn out that way. I'm trying to find out what's happening with cops now. And I should be able to find out a lot about it soon, because I just became reacquainted with Jan Jarbo, the San Antonio Express News reporter who you saw in here. And that happened. I hadn't talked to Jan in 10 or 12 years, 12 years at least. But now she's a syndicated national columnist. And her column appears regularly in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And which was neat. So one day I'm reading the Seattle Post-Intelligencer editorial page, and here's Jan Jarbo's name. Well, what if it's the same? Yes, San Antonio Express News, great column. And each week for the next 3 or 4 weeks, the same. So I emailed her and said, you know, I don't know if you remember me, but got money and like your column. And so she emailed me right back. And so I'm hoping we're going to talk on the phone as soon as I get back, and I want to kind of told her I wanted to find out what cops was doing now, but I don't know the answer if you ask me.
So you don't know what the barrio looks like now,
right? No, I mean, except it's, you know, considerably spruced up from what you saw at that time. San Antonio, the barrio was, there were a lot of improvements and cops made very positive changes. But there were some terrible setbacks in the late 80s caused by drugs that just really swept through the barrios there among the kids and other things. The crack cocaine thing and others were pretty devastating. And I know there were some major setbacks for cops and the things that they were doing. And then that began to improve again in the 90s. So, but I don't know. Hope to find out soon that what's now going on. But it was kind of remarkable to see how these folks organized. And Rosendo Urbaso, the priest you saw, is sort of no ordinary priest, although he has his little barrio church in one of the poorest areas in San Antonio. He also has a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley, and he did his PhD dissertation on liberation theology. And he teaches for part of the year at Boston College, but he's also a parish priest in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Did the Cortez lady trigger this whole thing?
Personally? No. Actually, a Cortez triggered the whole thing. A guy whose name was Ernie Cortez. And Ernie Cortez was an organizer for a group called the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was set up by the great sort of famous organizer Saul Alinsky, who worked first in Chicago in the area called the Back of the Yards, and then worked in Rochester, New York, and other places. And Saul Alinsky developed this Industrial Areas Foundation. He wrote a lot of books about how to do community organizing. And they trained in Chicago these people who would then go back to their homes. Ernie Cortez was from San Antonio. He went and studied with Saul Alinsky. And in the spring of 1973, he returned to San Antonio and started going around to the parishes trying to talk the priests into making an organization. And one of the things that Ernie Cortez was very interested in, he would go and sit in on the masses all the time, if the priests were at all interested. And he'd say, you know, I want to see who the people are. And he'd sit in the masses, and he'd sit in the church organizations, and he'd see that the power in the church, although the priests obviously had a lot of power, but the real people who made the church work were the women. And he found these women who were leaders in the church, and sort of cultivated this energy and turned them into political organizers. So of the first 10 presidents of COPS, only one was male. And it was these women who, many did also have outside jobs, but a number didn't, and who had spent a lot of time volunteering for the church, and he turned some of that energy into building the organization. Any other? It's getting along in time. You're all pretty tired, so thanks very much.